At the outset, I wish to extend a formal welcome to each of you on behalf of the Regents, the faculty, and the staff of Concordia Seminary. We are delighted with your presence and your participation in our 10th Annual Theological Symposium. The aim of our symposia series is to provide, as Dr. Bartelt suggested, a context for theological discussion and reflection on significant issues facing the church. In this purpose, this symposium is not unique. However, in two respects, it does possess a distinctive character. First, it is the last theological symposium of the century at Concordia Seminary, and its focus is a widely heralded juxtaposition of historical eras none of us here today will ever witness again in our lives: the dawn of a new century and the inauguration, at least in the popular mind, if not in all scholarly minds, of a new millennium. Second, the symposium this year is uniquely organized in featuring our own faculty in the majority of its presentations. While we continue to welcome and elicit insights from others in our ecclesial community at these symposia, I strongly believe that in this symposium and at this time, the church should hear the perspective of this seminary and its faculty on the challenges which await it in the future, and the understandings which comprise the foundations for the role of this institution in theological leadership in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I trust that this time of thought and conversation will be beneficial to your ministry and your study as, in a new age, we prepare to give an answer to everyone that asks, a reason for the hope that is in us. Recently, the History Channel on cable television featured a Roman Catholic priest, a Protestant theologian, and a Jewish rabbinical scholar discussing current religious trends. Nowhere were differences more evident than how they approached the new millennium, as it has been referred to in the media. The priest mentioned the Catholic Church's six-year plan to prepare what it calls the Great Jubilee of the year 2000, a bimillennial Eucharistic birthday party of sorts. The Protestant pointed out that the significance of the millennium within the diversity of Protestant Christianity has ranged from end-of-the-world prophetic apocalypticism to a symbolic rebirth of hope manifested in the Christ event. The rabbi observed that in the Jewish calendar, the year 2000 averages out to the year 5760. Had an imam been present, he no doubt would have added that Muslims consider it to be the year 1378. In other words, it would seem that for much of the world, the year 2000 will be just another year. And yet perhaps no chronological marker has prompted more excitement and speculation than the year 2000. For centuries, that monumental symbolic date has represented the future and what we shall make of it. The year 2000 has been operating like a powerful magnet on the world. It is amplifying emotions, accelerating change, heightening awareness, and inviting cultural and institutional re-examination. Indeed, since at least 1990, the date of January 1, 2000, has spawned a veritable cottage industry for futurologists, sociologists, anthropologists, journalists, and just about everyone else with a book to sell or a lecture to give on trends, megatrends, new directions for the new millennium, each rivaling the other in volatility and passion. The Christian community has not been immune from the millennial contagion either. There is the proliferation of monographs, volumes, periodical articles, and sermons on the subject, and they are so many that they have almost rendered such phrases as the challenges of the 21st century or hope for the new millennium shopworn and trite. Yet the hyperbole and pop sociological analysis dare not obscure the fact that important dimensions of the mission and message of the church will be different in the future than in the past. While, in the words of Hebrews 10, we hold unswervingly to the hope we profess as we transition to the 21st century, I am convinced that the context and contours of the profession of hope will be significantly altered by a variety of intellectual and cultural developments. Admittedly, I am not a prophet, nor a prophet's son, but I would argue that at least four such contemporary developments will continue to characterize the next century and define the need for the church's message of hope and give shape to that message in terms of our theological engagement with society and culture. The first of those four contemporary developments that will continue into the new century have to do with the global scope of economic, political, environmental, and social issues. And I believe that they will coalesce in the radical interdependence of the human family. The interdependence of the human family. The implication of these global realities in terms of religion will be staggering. Over two-thirds of the world's 5 billion people live outside the Christian faith. Many of these people live in the highly secularized Western world, where there are large numbers of nominal church members and large numbers of persons with no religious commitment. That two-thirds non-Christian majority on the eve of the 21st century includes 800 million Muslims, 750 million Hindus, 350 million Buddhists, and 1 billion Chinese who are Confucianist, Buddhist, Taoist, or Marxist. Even in our own country, while Christian groups combined claim a majority of the population, it is estimated that the single fastest growing group in America in the first years of the next century will be the unchurched population. However, unprecedented change in the ethnic and racial composition of the United States. By 2020, one-third of our national population will be Asian, African-American, or Hispanic. That unprecedented change in the ethnic and racial composition of the country will further change our religious landscape. The Islamic community has grown rapidly in America and now virtually equals the Jewish community in size. Eastern religions have extended their presence in the country through first-generation immigrant organizations But future growth may very well be through the conversion of thousands of young adult Americans to both Buddhism and Hindu religions. The Buddhist and Hindu communities each in the United States today have more than 5 million adherents. Again, on the global scale, the new century witnesses a shifting of the Christian population from north to south. In 1900, 87% of all Christians in the world lived in Europe and North America. By the end of next year, as much as 60% of all Christians living in the world will live in Latin America, Asia, and Africa. With the diversity and interdependence of cultures that will mark the new century, the church must develop a greater awareness of the need for evangelization and re-evangelization at home and abroad. It will need pastors and leaders who are sensitive to and knowledgeable about the cultures of those they serve, and who are able to adapt their message of hope in Jesus Christ to different contexts. The church will need pastors and leaders who can minister effectively to people from a diverse range of life situations, including ethnic origins, regional variations, and family situations. Global economic, cultural, and political realities will shape the overall setting of ministry in the next century. Beyond cultural and social change, the second trait I see significantly challenging the church's message of hope in the new century is intellectual and philosophical. Perhaps no other term purporting to define the underlying intellectual orientation of an entire age is given over to such confusion, imprecision, and misunderstanding than the term postmodernism. It is even used by Hollywood to describe motion pictures like Pulp Fiction and Reality Bites. They are postmodern movies. Postmodernism does not lend itself to clear definition. Indeed, it encompasses a broad spectrum of theories, and its practitioners seem to lose not a wink of sleep over the mutual incompatibility of certain projects that take shelter under its roof. Postmodernism is, in other words, a concept in search of a definition. And, try as I might, with that inherent Thomistic urge in me of not succumbing to the contemporary vice of taking ill-defined abstractions seriously, abstractions such as deconstructionism, feminism, postmodernism, I confess that the word is as suitable for describing the great intellectual and theological challenge of the church in the 21st century as any other word. To be sure, I am unprepared to say that the new millennium will be postmodern in terms of a style of culture, but I do believe that the church must be prepared to proclaim its message in confrontation with postmodernism as the reigning ideology in the world. Postmodernism is a reaction against modernity as it developed out of the Renaissance and Enlightenment. Modernity endeavored to establish life and thought on an objective foundation. It offered reason to examine critically every claim and to ground all knowledge. Reason provided a set of rules and criteria for thinking about reality, for knowing absolute truth. While the norms and criteria varied, Descartes had his clear and distinct ideas, science had its empiricist criteria, the Hegelians put their confidence in the progress of spirit, there did develop a rational foundation for truth in the modern period. In contrast, postmodernism repudiates any appeal to reality or truth. Postmodernism sees the world as contingent, ungrounded, diverse, indeterminate. The self is the source of truth and reality. Human knowledge is constructed by the whole person. In a postmodern world, society is a network of many individuals, each with his or her own sources of truth and power. There are no true propositions or valid meta-narratives. There is only the question of what words we should use. As Richard Rorty says, quote, anything can be made to look good or bad by being redescribed. Postmodernism invites us beyond a logical or theological discussion of good and evil, of an objective text, of a conceptually organized knowledge of things. There is ample evidence that the most fundamental tenets of postmodernism are widely embraced as we move into a new century. George Barna conducted three nationwide surveys, one in 1991, one in 1993, and another in 1994, addressing the matter of absolute truth versus relative truth and morals. The results of the surveys indicate that the vast majority of Americans are adopting a relativistic view of truth in larger numbers that cut across age, gender, and racial differences. In 1991, Barna found that 28% of all adult respondents strongly agreed with the statement, there is no such thing as absolute truth. An additional 39% said they more or less agreed with that statement. When the same statement was posed in 1994, the number who strongly agreed that there was no such thing as absolute truth had risen to 32%, and the number who somewhat agreed rose to 40%. The generation leading the way toward relativism was, Barna discovered, the baby busters. Born between 1965 and 1983, the adults in that generation rejected the idea that there is such a thing as absolute truth by 78%. Point is, as Dorothy once said to Toto, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore. As we approach the year 2000, we must realize that what Stanley Hauerwas says in his book, Resident Aliens, has been going on since the 1960s. We are not in the Kansas of modernity anymore. And because of that fact, the church must consider and fashion new approaches for its presentation and articulation of the gospel. Postmodernism will make Christian belief problematic for many people more than the traditional intellectual challenges to the faith ever have. It is no longer an issue of the credibility of the Christian faith. In the culture of the 21st century, the church will not even begin to speak about credibility until it establishes plausibility. While postmodernism may be the most pervasive intellectual challenge to the faith in the new millennium, there are a host of others: spiritual movements, world religions, secular philosophies of all types, all of which offer competing claims to which Christians must be prepared to respond. The fact is that we can no longer depend on a Christian culture to transmit fundamental Christian values. The new century will require pastors who are adept in the faith, who are more theologically aware and prepared, not less. The church will need leaders competent to preach and teach the truths of the faith with accuracy and clarity. And who, in that time-honored understanding of the Lutheran ministerial use of reason, will employ valid insights from philosophy, psychology, literature, and the arts in communicating the Christian hope in a culture of profound despair, even over truth itself. A third feature of the 21st century context, which I believe will loom large for the mission and message of the church, is continued technological advance. Commentators on trends in the new century unanimously agree that telecommunications and computers will continue to drive change, just as manufacturing did during the Industrial Age. The foundations for an international information highway system have already been laid. We are rapidly moving to a single worldwide information network, just as economically we are becoming one global marketplace. We continue toward the capability to communicate anything to anyone, anywhere, by any form, voice, data, text, image, at the speed of light. Experts say that the greatest peril facing us in the next century will not be nuclear war, but the breakdown of all communications and information systems. These rapid developments in technology have changed how people think, learn, and communicate. Such new technologies will offer unprecedented opportunities for disseminating the Christian message of hope and salvation, and for making theological resources widely accessible. But at the same time, technologies are not neutral. Machines are created by humans, and our technologies will bear the marks of both our greatness and our sinfulness. Some years ago, Jacques Ellul warned of the effect of technique on life through his book, The Technological Society. He cautioned against a soulless technology in the service of pleasure and power. He talked about the non-negotiables of a technological society: utility, productivity, efficiency. But at the dawn of the new millennium, the 20th century concerns of Ellul seem tame. Many forecasters speak of a technological worldview as reaching people more broadly and deeply than either a scientific or economic worldview. In short, they say, technism, the ideology of technology, will be the dominant spirit of the new millennium. Technicism entails the pretension of the autonomous individual to control the whole of reality. Man, as master, seeks victory over the future. He is to have everything his way. He is to solve problems old and new. As my colleague David Berger opined in a Concordia Journal article, computers and communications technologies, quote, have become so pervasive that they are largely transparent. In them, we live and move and have our being. The complete application of technicism may result in a society built on a technological model. And as this process intensifies in the future, its perils will become more ominous. It is also true that technicism's definition of reality is really alien to reality. Defined biblically, reality is an entity with an origin, existence, and destiny given to it by God. But technological reality has no relation to meaningful creation. Indeed, Gary Mann of Augustana College has argued that the most profound and challenging phenomena in 21st century culture will be the impact of information technology on the very concept of reality. He speaks of technosticism. Quote, the exponential expansion of a disembodying technical reason which can virtually create a world without the body. It is and will be for us an important theological issue. How disembodied should our communication be? When cyberspace begins to replace embodied interactions, what happens to the emphasis on the incarnational nature of our faith? Is not, as one theologian suggested, flesh required for ethics? As with any paradigm shift, serious work must be done by future pastors and theologians in terms of the relevance of the Christian message for the technological context. It may be that the doctrine of creation must once again be picked up as a teaching of significant urgency, and not as if the old model of Darwinian evolution will inevitably be the only enemy of orthodoxy. The technological world cannot be made independent of creation. Also, the church may need to participate more seriously in the dialogue between theology and science, particularly the natural sciences, so that religious and theological affirmations are understood. In any event, a world in which increasing use of technology may only accelerate dehumanization, isolation, and alienation among human beings, that world will desperately need to hear from the church an informed message of hope in the one who holds all power in heaven and on earth, and who has fulfilled that power in a person, Jesus Christ. A fourth, and for the purpose of these admittedly brief remarks, final challenge to the mission and ministry of the church I see in the next century will be a profound sense of pluralism. A profound sense of pluralism. Cultural pluralism will shape the context for the future mission and message of the church in two ways. First, pluralism means sheer diversity. It forces us to recognize that there are many cultures, many ethnic groups, many traditions, and indeed many worlds inhabited by our own one humanity. In the 21st century, we will continue to experience the influence of a broad spectrum of people with all their attendant values and lifestyles. But there is a second dimension to cultural pluralism than just the fact of diversity. Pluralism represents an approach to diversity. It celebrates and enshrines difference, and in the process, it too is transformed into an ideology. Pluralism has been tersely yet aptly described by Charles Taylor as, quote, the politics of recognition, the recognition of the other. We have, Taylor asserts, an obligation to recognize the dignity and worth of cultures and beliefs other than our own. If this characterization of pluralism is correct, there should be no reason why a Christian should not embrace it. But in an increasingly pluralistic society, the concept of pluralism will become problematic for Christians because it ultimately extends to the issue of the plurality of religions and the exclusive claims of Christian truth. The religious pluralism of John Hick, for instance, states that divine truth is present in all religions and that hope of salvation takes place within these religions in a plurality of ways. No revelation, he says, contains God or absolute reality. Rather, each revelation is only the real as it is perceived or conceived by particular human beings in particular and diverse cultural contexts. In his work entitled God Has Many Names, Hick proposes a, quote, Copernican revolution in theology, whereby Christianity will be displaced from the center of the universe of faiths to its periphery, along with the other religions, all of which, Hick says, quote, circle equidistantly from God, the shared center. The relationship between Christianity and other religions may very well be the paramount issue for the church as it lives its life in the future in the context of radical pluralism. In the past, a person's worldview, or life world, as some sociologists label it, was minimally challenged. One rarely rubbed shoulders with people who put their world together in significantly different ways or lived their lives in accordance with significantly different values. Through most of human history, individuals lived in worlds that were more or less unified. Peter Berger writes, quote, compared with modern societies, most earlier ones evinced a high degree of integration. Whatever the difference between various sectors of life, these would hang together in an order of integrating meaning that included them all. Berger goes on to say that a unifying center to give coherence and meaning to the totality of life today, however, has been lost. The pluralistic situation on the cusp of a new century multiplies the number of competing life worlds and places each on the defensive. It is this pluralistic milieu, above all else, which triggers the commonly heard response of Hick that one religion or set of values is as good as any other. We're all trying to get to the same place. We just follow different paths. In the 21st century, how can the Christian acknowledge other religions while understanding God's truth to be identical with Christ, the Word of God? And now, a concluding comment. In his Systematic Theology, Paul Tillich speaks of the theology of correlation, that the Christian faith must, in some measure, correlate to the existential condition of humankind. Prescinding from all of the erroneous theological baggage Tillich brings to his proposal, here his point has validity. It amounts to correlating our theology to the needs of people and in the world in which they live, which will be different in the next millennium. Certainly, the world must never be allowed to dictate the theological agenda of the church. But on the other hand, we should not allow the perversion of that old motto, "Christ is the answer," by the response, "But what's the question?" The church on the brink of a new millennium, indeed. The issues and the questions prompted by changed cultural conditions and trends I have described, albeit somewhat superficially. Those issues and questions are different from those of the world in which our church previously operated. A world of enormously different cultures and contexts, a world of despairing of hope for truth, a world controlled by technological power and reducing everything to components of a great technical whole, and a world helpless to differentiate between competing claims. In these last days of 1999, and in these days of this theological symposium, we are called to bring our considerable theological resources and thinking to bear on the larger questions of the 21st century. And those questions are not who can vote at a church business meeting, or which hymnal we are to use, or who can read the lessons on Sunday morning. On the edge of a new century, the challenges are much more formidable. And yet the Lord of history, who has given us these challenges, has also given us his eternal word and the ability and gifts to meet them. And most importantly, I am convinced that we can do this while maintaining our strong confessional identity as Lutherans in the new century. But we must bring some measure of courage to our confessionalism. Some in our church appear to be embarrassed about the doctrine of our confessions. Some actually believe that there will be no room for the confessions and their theology in the 21st century, that confessional theology is hopelessly out of date and irrelevant. For others, the term confessional is but a mantra to be cited in the preservation of the status quo, that worst of all utopias, according to Jürgen Moltmann. Or for others, the term confessional is invoked to protect oneself from meaningful contact with those with whom one may disagree. Or confessional may be used as a justification simply to ignore the fact of change. Courageous confessionalism takes risks. Courageous confessionalism is so confident in our Lutheran identity and doctrine that we are willing to learn from others and dare to answer those challenges which await us. And courageous confessionalism is evangelical. It remembers what is at the very heart of our confession and what will be at its heart in a new century. The content of the gospel is this, says the formula, that the Son of God, Christ our Lord, himself assumed and bore the curse of the law and expiated and paid for all our sins, that through him alone we re-enter the good graces of God, obtain forgiveness of sins through faith, and are saved eternally. Courageous confessionalism serves the gospel. And finally, in a world searching for hope, courageous Lutheran confessionalism is itself hopeful. It does not ignore society. It does not see it as the great bastion for everything, and the church should be protected from it. We dare not adopt H. Richard Niebuhr's Christ and culture paradigm of Christ against culture and simply say that all of the philosophy and all of the thinking and all of the theological discussions, because they are alien to our confession and faith, are simply to be ignored and never studied and never considered and never confronted. Contemplating the challenges of a new century, not to mention a new millennium, might lead some to despair or prompt a wholesale condemnation of contemporary culture. But to quote Moltmann again, the sin of despair is hopelessness. Our confessions, after all, explicitly reject Manichaeanism. We don't enter the new century wondering how it's all going to come out in the end. We don't enter a new century in doubt about who is going to be victorious in some apocalyptic struggle between good and evil. We are not Manichaeans. At the dawn of a new millennium, we live under the declaration of Jesus, "Behold, I saw Satan like lightning fall from heaven." And we live in his promise, "In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world." Thanks.